guys, you have that idea? If you can put that back.
Thank you.
All the testimony that we've heard today has focused on reasons why or why not CDC should expand its AIDS surveillance case definition. Over the last 3 years, change the definition to include additional lies in the context of a disease-based system has become a battle cry by people in cities around the country. I want to focus my time today on another definition, however, the definition of an AIDS activist, a definition which has been variously maligned and confused, but a definition nonetheless of a group of individuals whose work has brought us to this meeting today. AIDS activists, all of whom are living with HIV, not AIDS advocates, identified the politics and problems of the CDC definition and organized and educated thousands of individuals around the U.S. and the world into a targeted campaign to bring about change. Activists analyzed data, got information, organized demos, wrote letters and postcards, zapped this man right here, Mason and others, in what has now become a three-year effort to force the CDC to use existing science, not thinly veiled politics, to track the scope of AIDS in this country. Activists, not advocates, continue to oppose the addition of 200 T-cells as an indicator because they are inaccurate, unscientific, inaccessible, and they are not a predictor of disease. The CDC knows it, and the NIAID-MAP data prove it. A little over a year ago, activists stood alone in mounting a different consensus campaign, one which included the addition of pulmonary tuberculosis. Many advocate organizations rejected our arguments then. How many lives were lost by their denial of the reality of the discussions that we are finally coming to today? Activists, not advocates, continue to confront the CDC about their refusal to research the ways and the extent of lesbian transmission and infection. It is unacceptable, as Dr. Curran argued in Amsterdam, to count lesbians as heterosexuals. Activists understand the political maneuvering represented by this latest proposal from the CDC. Why, for example, was pelvic inflammatory disease removed from the July Category B classification document when existed in the November classification document? We understand that all of your unsubstantiated arguments against anti-cervical cancer and other GY infections were deleted from this most current document because AIDS activists responded to your November 91 propaganda with accurate and substantive information. We understand that a move towards staging of disease is a smokescreen for mandatory reporting, and we understand that by simply adding severe to the most current proposal from your office to your latest iteration as an attempt to justify, for example, the inclusion of lymphoma at the expense of cervical cancer. AIDS activists organized to ensure that the clinicians treating women and injection drug users were allowed to speak today and that HIV-positive people living with these infections, which are ignored, were heard. However, Judith Cohen, as you've heard before, a research epidemiologist from San Francisco, who has been an outspoken and credible opponent of the CDC at the expense of her own funding dollars, was summarily dismissed by them as a potential panelist. AIDS activists know that the OIs that are proposed by the coalition today are rapidly progressing, presenting with different and aggressive manifestations and are not a result of class or economic status, but a result of immunocompromise associated with HIV infection. The CDC is not responsible for access to health care, that is true, but it is responsible for tracking the scope of this epidemic, and the three OIs discussed today at this meeting must be added to accurately track the epidemic in all HIV-infected persons. AIDS activists will continue to push the CDC to change the definition because we know that the syndrome called AIDS requires it. We know, however, that our fight will continue because John Warren told members of the coalition that he intends for this to be the last time discussed the CDC definition. This is unacceptable with a complex and changing syndrome, and it is certainly unacceptable without national health care and anti-discrimination provisions. Dr. Curran, you told us in Amsterdam that a timeline to implement changing the definition would be issued by August 3rd. This hearing is not a substitute for your timeline, and we urge you in your wrap-up today to make that timeline public. AIDS activists will not be silent until the CDC funds AIDS education, which includes explicit and accurate information on same-sex transmission and clean works. A cryptic just say no message and an 800 number across the screen just aren't good enough. AIDS activists know that there is data to support adding bacterial infections, pulmonary TB, and cervical cancer to the definition, and we will continue to push from the inside and out until the CDC does just that. These are the actions that define an AIDS activist, and for these reasons, I am proud to define myself as one. Act up, fight back, fight AIDS.
The next speaker is Dr. Ed Thompson, Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologist.
I find myself in an interesting position as a white male physician from a state health department. I wind up being suspect by everyone here on at least one ground. It's even worse when you look at the program and learn that I am a Southerner as well. However, I find myself in agreement with almost everyone here on at least some points, and on most points with most everyone. All of us agree that we must do whatever needs to be done to increase the availability of care to persons with HIV infection, AIDS, and a variety of other health conditions in this country without regard to their ability to pay for it. All of us agree that we must increase the awareness of conditions about the manifestations of HIV infection. All of us agree that the entitlement program must be expanded to provide benefits to those who need them because of their HIV infection or for a variety of other conditions, most of them socioeconomically intertwined. And yet we disagree in some cases on the ways to achieve these goals. Two men were walking down the street and saw a third man standing on the staircase wrestling mightily with the piano. One of the two men walking down the street rushed the aid of the man with the piano. And after several minutes of sweating and running and heaving, they succeeded in getting the piano to the top of the stair landing. The man who had rushed to the assistance of the man with the piano said, "Boy, that was tough. I bet you would never have gotten it up here without my help." And the man who had been dealing with the piano to begin with says, "Yes, that was tough. I would never have gotten it up here without your help. I was trying to get it down." We have to know what we're about. And that's the one point on which we have not yet reached agreement. What we are about here is accurately counting the occurrence of severe HIV disease, accurately counting the occurrence of AIDS. That is the task at hand. And if we allow ourselves to be diverted from that task, we may wind up counting inaccurately. Speakers have presented numerous reasons underlying the surveillance why the inclusion of different conditions would be beneficial, with a couple of notable exceptions. No one has presented reasons related to that have indicated that we should add most of these conditions. Major concerns continue to be access to treatment, eligibility for benefits and entitlements, and clinician awareness. This is a surveillance definition. It's used to determine eligibility for benefits, access to services or entitlements, to educate clinicians how to provide care, or to raise people's consciousness. It's inappropriate. Other definitions and other tools must be used for these purposes. Try to construct a surveillance definition suitable for these purposes is both scientifically unsound and counterproductive. To be included in an accurate surveillance case definition, a condition must not only be at least moderately associated with the condition under study, but also be relatively uncommon in the general population or other uninfected populations, so that its presence is at least reasonably specific for the condition to be defined. There's little question that tuberculosis, cervical cancer, many of the other gynecological conditions mentioned are exacerbated by HIV infection, and that they're associated with it to varying degrees, some of them quite strong. However, most of these conditions are not rare in the general population. I'm reminded of comments made earlier today. I find myself uncomfortable disagreeing with individuals such as D.A. Henderson, who was quoted, and sometimes even disagreeing with Jim Kern, but I must, on one point, with both of them. Surveillance is neither the brain, the nervous system, nor the conscience of the killer. It is the eyes. If those eyes and their vision are distorted by lenses of social considerations, political concerns, popular opinion, or even genuine empathetic concerns, then we do not see the truth. The information on which the brain reasons, to which the nervous system reacts, and with which the conscience judges guides, it's false. We must remember the purpose of surveillance. Give us the information and then we must force the other elements of public health and medical care to address the other issues that need to be addressed. I would propose the following to CSCE when I return to that group to get its reaction to the appropriate course with regard to the AIDS surveillance case definition. Number one, data are sufficient now to add CD4 cell counts of less than 200 to the list of AIDS-defining conditions, and this should be done with, pardon the expression, all deliberate speed. Second, data suggest that recurrent bacterial pneumonia and invasive cervical carcinoma may be sufficiently associated with HIV infection, and more importantly, sufficiently unassociated with the general population to be reasonably specific for HIV infection, and more data need to be developed to determine whether this is the case or not, rapidly. If this is the case, then these two should also be included very soon after this expansion. Third, I would suggest that data for inclusion of the other conditions mentioned are not yet present, because the data should be sought by those who believe they should be included and presented, and that if those data are developed at some later date, other conditions as well be added to the surveillance case definition. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you all for staying this late. I flew all night last night, so if I start rambling incoherently, please just take me quietly away from the podium. The first thing I'd like to do is ask if anybody in this room will be happy with the 1987 case definition through November 6th. Would you raise your hand? Yeah. I just wanted to be sure we were all together that we would really like a change in the short term rather than in the long term. I'd like to concur with one speaker who said we shouldn't be here. I really think there's been an unacceptable delay in the implementation of an expanded case definition in our country. I'm not going to point fingers about that delay. I think we all need to share some responsibility. We've all been bashing each other a lot, and in the course of our bashing, I worry that we have lost sight of where we're going on this. I have to share with you in all frankness why my membership, many members of my membership, viewed the delay at the last minute, that crucial non-signing of the expanded case definition, as a Pyrrhic victory in some senses. In fact, many of my states are in extremely tight financial straits. I was surprised to see anybody from California here. I didn't know you could buy airline tickets with IOUs. That's only one example. Every single state budget is under severe fiscal stress. Every public health budget at every state level is under severe fiscal stress. Those of us who have fought and fought and fought to preserve state dollars and aids are finding ourselves losing the battle. And my state, which is number 7 in investment in aids nationwide, has just decided to pay $2.9 million out of our state aids funds, despite many, many discussions and all the protestations and community involvement that we could bring to bear. The point is, the cuts are now to the level in most states where even valuable state AIDS funding is going away. So what I did when I heard that not July 1st, but sometime in the future, we were going to have an expanded definition, I asked my membership, what does this mean to you? Can you tell me what this costs you? And I asked them in three areas. I asked them the cost of the public process. I'm not just talking about the fact that we all felt like Linus trying to kick the football and Lucy is taking it away again. That's only part of it. We actually spent a lot of public money in the public process that we went forward through. Connecticut spent $25,000, Washington State spent $53,000, and Oregon spent about $45,000. That's not a lot of money, but if you consider my state, it cost about $70,000 to take care of the person with AIDS, you can get some perspective of what we could have done with those monies had we not invested in the public process that in fact didn't bring us to the case definition. Entitlement issues. How much are we losing in entitlement? What does that really mean? Everyone says a surveillance definition shouldn't be linked to entitlement. You know, pigs should fly. Let's be honest, it is. That's the reality I work with. I get money in my state depending on how many AIDS cases I count. That may not be the ideal way from a policy point of view. That's the reality I work with. In the state of Colorado, Denver wouldn't become a Title I city. The $2 million to fight AIDS in that state had this definition done when it was first proposed. South Carolina would have qualified for additional Title II funds because they've had they would have seen a 47% increase in their AIDS cases over what they're counting now in that state. But Oregon, which probably keeps the best records of almost any state except Washington, was able to come up with a very precise estimate in that state, which is a small state, of how much it had cost them, the 6-month delay only in implementation of the definition, and they came up with a $50 cost. You add Title II entitlements and Medicaid reimbursement. Clearly, we're moving away from the diagnosis of AIDS as a way to get Medicaid reimbursement, and I endorse that, but the fact is we're not to a completely disability-based model yet, and so this means real dollars to go away from patient care. The final question I ask my membership is, what does it cost you in terms of credibility? And I'd like to share with you just a little bit of some of what people said, because I found it particularly instructive. In Colorado, the AIDS director said, CBOs are very upset with the delay because it affects their ability to plan effectively and develop fundraising strategies to meet the inevitable demand for services. Nebraska, the director said, well, with only vague and unsubstantiated reasons for the delay, trust in the system has been seriously jeopardized. There's a strong perception in a segment of the Nebraskan population that CDC and subsequently the State Department of Health is trying to withhold important information, and this delay only feeds that perception. In Oklahoma, they say, we encourage the CDC to take immediate action to implement the division of an AIDS case definition. And that was pretty much the refrain. I won't go state by state, I don't have time. But these are the comments from the people that are living a reality, just the same kind of reality that we're all living who are affected by this epidemic. It affects every one of us, it affects our friends, our family. All of us have lost people to this epidemic. And people in my office are not there because this is their professional goal, they're there because they're fighting an epidemic. I think it's long past time we had this expanded case definition. And whatever is decided on the fine points of it, at this point, we're already late. Thank you very much.
My next speaker is Samita Taylor from the National Minority AIDS Coalition.
I'm Representative of the National Minority AIDS Council. I am here with the support of nearly 500 community-based organizations serving communities of color, primarily in helping to develop leadership within those communities of color that are fighting. I'm also a co-signer of the consensus statement that you've heard discussed here today. Just a time, so it's not to be redundant, my statement is greatly condensed with the understanding that the full written testimony will be submitted. I support and agree with much of the testimony that you have heard here today, specifically that which was given from the ACLU and from the AIDS Action Council. I have been asked by my membership to express two specific reasons for inclusion of the psychological manifestations of the virus in women in discussion, including specifically CNN. An appropriate CDC AIDS case definition, a surveillance definition, has the potential to do two additional things that are being intended to do. First is to sensitize healthcare practitioners to the possibility of HIV treatment. And the second is to increase the possibility for early diagnosis and treatment of those women. I appreciate the charge of the CDC to develop sound public health policy. It must be understood that part of the development of such policy is an appreciation of the impact of that policy upon the public health community and the individuals that it serves. The presence of HIV and AIDS has dramatically and possibly forever changed the manner in which care is delivered, specifically within indigenous communities. Your definition of this disease plays a major role in determining one's accessibility to both social security benefits and that it has not been the intent of public health officials. The fact remains that that is the established precedent. However, for most affected women, this has meant very little. Dedication to the development of sound public health policy as it relates to the Centers for Disease Control's case definition. Its definition is equality of people.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Our next speaker is Ms. Susan Shaw, the People with AIDS Coalition, who's also a journalist.
I don't need my time. My name is Susan Shaw, and I work with the People with AIDS Coalition in New York City. Marina Alvarez, who is an HIV-positive Puerto Rican woman from New York, was supposed to do this, but she was not feeling well, so here I am. And I'm going to start to present her remarks, which are free. The PWA Coalition is the nation's largest self-help organization by and for people living with HIV and AIDS, and provides a number of services to PWAs and their families. We have a national toll-free hotline staffed by people with AIDS and HIV, two magazines in Spanish and English, and a sister sister project providing support for women of color. We work with and hear the issues and problems of thousands of women with HIV, injecting drug users, and people without access to health care. People with AIDS in these communities all too often are misdiagnosed, undercounted, and cannot even get their basic medical needs met. It is unfortunate that more of the people who we are discussing today, the women, Blacks, Hispanics, poor people, and people with a history of addicting drug use, cannot be here today to fight for their rights, to express their concerns, to share with them personally their needs. This is too often the case. The PWA Coalition strongly endorses the addition to the CDC surveillance case definition, the three conditions we've discussed here today, tuberculosis, primary CIN. I'd like to add that it appears to me that CDC's reluctance to include these three conditions, questionable, these are a higher clinical standard, looks like it's based on a reluctance to recognize difference and a local belief that studies in men ought to cover everybody, men and women. We've been told today that right now there are no gender-specific infections in the surveillance definition. That's not true. Capacity sarcoma is prevalent in the United States. HIV affects different people differently. We would like science to be apolitical, but the fact is that science is political, and people with AIDS are trying to use it to their best interests. Listen to us and change the definition to include these conditions now. We can wait no longer. People's lives.
Next speaker is Dr. David Carpenter, the Illinois Department of Health Public Health, representing the Association of Dr. Perrin.
Membership is in 50 states and four territories that have public health departments and the laboratory directors are associated with the department. I'd just like to touch on five issues in terms of laboratory capabilities that are available for before testing. Five issues, which are accessibility, availability, capability, capacity, and of course, funding. If you look at the accessibility and availability, if I could address those jointly, yes, it does exist, it is out there, and you cannot minimize the fact that to put that in place in each of the entities where now exists costs $150,000, $200,000. That's fixed cost, that's what you do in the first test. Now, is it universal and adequate? No, it's not. And if you consider the issues regarding this, I mean, there is various colors in the rainbow or the geographic terrain of the United States. And by that comment, I mean that when you consider to do a valid test on an individual, a valid TB4 test, you have to get a blood sample, you have to do a white blood cell count, you have to do a differential, and it's recommended to do the test within 6 hours. And you do that test if you have the optimum anticoagulant, which is generally considered to be EPA. If you use an anticoagulant like heparin, it's extended somewhat to about 24 hours. Now, if you look at capability and capacity that is available in state public health laboratories, Dr. McDonough indicated in the OK report at the beginning of the year, there were six to seven labs. It's now increased to about a dozen. And you cannot ignore the capabilities that exist in many university laboratories. And the driving force to do the test is different. In the states who are getting into this business are doing it to aid in the assessment of the HIV epidemic. That's the primary purpose. If you look at universities, generally that is not the primary purpose. They're also associated with monitoring transplantation and for doing research. There are two exceptions. There are two state public health laboratories in this country who have their laboratories university-based, that's by state statute. So they are more like the other state public health laboratories in universities. And of course, commercial labs, when you do the CD4 test or other lymphocyte test or immunotyping for profit. So that addresses accessibility, availability, capabilities. Yes, they do exist. But if This new AIDS definition is implemented. Obviously, the capabilities are not going to be equally available to everybody. And so if we need to add accessibility and availability by designating new centers, it probably take 4 to 6 months to put all this into place. When the tests are done, are they pretty good? Yes. Proficiency test known as the TLI MDT is run right here from CDC. And that's something that I think we can all be comfortable with in terms of the laboratories that are producing the data. Another capability of at least the state public health laboratories is the incredible record of confidentiality. And in those states where there's anonymous testing, the maintenance of the confidential data that does emanate from these laboratories. The capacity. Generally, the capacity is found to be somewhat in excess in the entities where it currently exists. With implementation of this new AIDS definition, will that capacity still be there? I don't know. I can't answer that. But if it's not, we are obviously going to be back to addressing accessibility and availability issues. Funding, diverting funding from prevention issues, probably not a real thing to even consider at this point because the funds are not entirely adequate and obviously finite. Kind of cost we're talking about, the $40 to $50 is generally considered to be the cost of doing a C4 immunophenotyping. Where's the funding going to come from for HIV monitoring? Well, it may very well have to come from the state. From the states, if the level of federal funding is not that it's going to be adequate to cover. State legislatures are going to have to address this issue and to consider and perhaps approve. But the last appeal is, when you look at CD4 in the universe of all of the tests, including the proposals for pulmonary TB, bacterial pneumonia, pap smear, HDV DNA, we're talking about laboratory tests. Those of you responsible for formulating your proposal to address all the issues in the HIV epidemic, I certainly ask you not to forget the laboratory component with the cost associated with it. Now, and on a very positive note, the Association of State Territory Public Health Laboratories has a lot of data. And that pile of data are costly. In 1986, there were about 25 million tests in this country. The average is about $6.50. In 1991, which is the FDA data, there were about 30 million tests done, and the average cost is down to about $4.30. Net positive note, thank you.
Our last speaker is the former pediatrician. Infectious disease specialist, Dean of the School of Public Health, University of Michigan. Chairperson of the National Commission on AIDS at the Juvenile Hospital.
Thanks, Tim, especially for that former pediatrician. I wanted to make a couple of comments in general before coming specifically on some of the issues that we've brought up today. I will speak in my role, although one of the comments I wanted to make relates to a close of the work that my team's done for several after that. I don't represent the commission, however, like the rest of you, the short notice didn't cause her to see where everybody's standing right now, so I don't think that it's understood. Very much reminded, if I can be excused, of personal musing here for one first time about AIDS for a large audience back in 1985, and commented that my most favorite mentor had often said the first step to solving the problem was cure. And I think I was re-reminded of that in an exercise I did over the summer. A large group of people looking at how the domestic policy, particularly in this country, on track again, is in the final throes of putting together a transition book that would be available to anybody in the party who wanted to take an aggressive approach to that set of problems, and asked me to write a chapter about what could be done urgently about AIDS, which I have done. My first reaction was, wow, I better cool. A chance to sit down and really say what I think I know about that. When I sat down, I discovered that I constantly had myself in the middle of the swamp. I would start thinking about problems halfway into the problem and working with a set of assumptions that I did not know had grown like moss over my thinking in this last 10 years. And listening today, I have a feeling we all have a little of that problem. That we get some of our anger, some of our agitation is being directed at mid-course problems that reflect a bad start in the wrong direction. And whatever else we do, I think that we probably have simply got to keep in mind what is it we would want to do, What is it we are actually trying to do? And what is it that we have had to compromise for reasons that we may regret, may try and change? It makes quite a difference in how we feel about each other, for sure, and a little bit of difference in what one decides to do. Doing that exercise, after a while, it got a little easier again as I began to realize just how encrusted my thinking had gotten about AIDS policy, how much I assumed that I had to be dealing, for instance, with discrimination. Everything we talk about in this day's conference is and absolutely should be colored by our concern about confidentiality and threat of discrimination. And anybody who objects to the idea that that happens hasn't been listening well. So that's got to be part of the discussion when we get to the finals. But what we should be concerned about is what would we do if we really had a good society here? Well, we would want to be taking care of people. We would want to know how many people needed care. We would want to know at the earliest opportunity that they could sense in intervening in their care, and in most instances with the people that we're talking about, that would be very early because they don't, a lot of them have access to primary care now. And how can you deal with an isolated CD4 count, the person who's never had a history of physical? That's the kind of thing of being set of accolades that we have simply got to recognize the reality of what we would want to do if we were a humane society, and then start working toward that. That's got to be on the one side. The other side, of course, has to be the realization that we have some harsh things to build from. We do have a systematic under-attention to women's health. And part of what we're seeing in the discussions that go on here, part of the anger, part of the difficulty of the discussion, comes from the fact that it is too systemic. And that has to be redressed. And in that context, one of the things that make the whole discussion so hard is that we are dealing with a grossly undereducated set of health professionals who still pretend to themselves that they can walk away from this epidemic if they simply choose their practice site right, that they need never know about HIV if they don't practice in New York or New Jersey or on the West Coast. That's so wrong, and we've got to fix that. I was glad to see Steve Bowen was here today. Hearst has got to work very, very hard, and very much more urgently, I think, in order to anticipate and enhance physician and healthcare professional education, but particularly physician education. If that were true, then our discussions about the various stages of cervical dysplasia and so forth would be nowhere near as difficult and as central as they seem to be right now, because people would be working off the base of understanding that here's a preventable disease of women. We have better knowledge than we seem to about its natural history and progression. And as I listen to it, we're hearing about something that's progressing more rapidly and maybe indeed warrant a great deal of attention, even if it is a widespread illness. So, and of course, all of us, as been mentioned several times today, are dealing with the issue as if we assume that inequity of healthcare access. We must not do that. We must assume that it is time to fix the access issue. Even my friends at the Department of Health and Human Services will agree with me that access is absolutely fundamental to whatever additional health care programs go forward. And so we need simply to be saying that loudly when we find ourselves arguing on a basis of inequity of access. A couple of specific points I want to make, and then I'm going to turn this over to Jim. Access does relate to the CD4 issue, as was just mentioned. And in a way that I may be a little more aware of than any of you who've been based in one geographic area mostly. The middle of this country doesn't know we have an epidemic now. They really don't. And we've been talking from urban bases today, we've been talking from vantage points in which we know a lot about the epidemic, but out there, and out there isn't too far west of the coast, east coast or east of the west coast, we have real problems. I worry about even further distortion of some of the scoring of this epidemic, which I think most of us would accept is moving fastest and most dangerously because it's unannounced, into smaller communities and into rural areas. That's something I hope, as you talk, you will pay awfully good attention to, because I can easily foresee CD4 testing, again, pushing us to a coastal epidemic where the sophistication is sufficient. And if you make criteria of how you can do the CD4 testing without which not, you do have the risk of making that worse and making the inequities worse in the middle of the country. So be very careful about that. The comment was made about psychological impacts, and I wanted to mention briefly that the Commission had had a day-long hearing on this issue, and we were party to suggesting better slow down in January.
Part of the reason was the Social Security stuff, which was only just on the table at that time. And since then, a couple of the commissioners, Don Goldman and Harlan Dalton, who've been working very closely with the Social Security Administration, it's my understanding that they feel much more comfortable now than they did at the time of that hearing, that things are in fact tracking along okay. But there was a bunch of potentially untoward effects. The Ryan White discussion you've heard today is a little worrisome to me, because to qualify for Ryan White, if 40 cities instead of 17 or 18 suddenly qualify, is to qualify for half as much funds as everybody would have before, and may turn something that's already puny into a nothingness in the qualifying. So that's not as clean an issue. We should all be shouting for full funding of Ryan White to start with, following which the provision that allows for the number of AIDS cases might even be looked at again in another way. We don't have to have that hallowed. We're letting it stay hallowed because nobody wants to go through the congressional fight that when I sat with Jeannie White in the Senate gallery and tried to morally influence the discussion below just to get it through the first time. So it's worrisome, but keep in mind on what our problems are. Confidentiality, I'm afraid I'm still very uneasy, as was the commission, about the potential adverse impacts on confidentiality of a straightforward, reasonably fast-moving approach to use of CD4 as a survey. I think that there are some instances of abuse. There's plenty of imagination for potential abuse, and I would urge that CDC look at the ways in which that can be safeguarded and anticipated. We've learned a lot in 11 years, and some of those lessons should be brought to bear. Finally, I think that the case has been very nicely made by the coalition of people who obviously sat down constructively to try and take what had been an almost frazzlingly complicated argument about many, many, many diagnoses that pertain almost surely to the sad progression of HIV disease in women. And out of that have distilled a very sensible set of proposals, which I think need to be considered carefully. I think will be considered carefully. There have been a few commentators who suggested or inferred that the listeners weren't being as thoughtful as the presenters. I don't think that's true. I think you've been listened to very carefully today, and my guess is that a very substantial fraction of the thought and energy that you've put into this will go to good purpose. I have just one suggestion there. Let us all celebrate rather than saying, I told you so. Anger is really at its best when it is funneled into constructive action, as that compromise suggests. And now that if indeed one can reach a resolution of that sort, then funneling that anger further in the direction of universal access to health care, marked improvement in provider education, a much greater attention to the inattention that has been paid to women's health. All of those are plenty of places for us to put our hand in.
We're faced with the choice of whether to take open discussion with the panel. We're not faced with any choice.
And that's true for the other disease processes also.
But the other thing I recognize is that we see this simply because there's, because we have a lot of TV to begin with, we see this much more, it's much more prevalent. It makes this incredible catch-22 if we apply to it the pure standard of epidemiology, which is that you don't put something into a surveillance definition if it happens all the time around you. It is my strongly held opinion that what we're seeing in HIV-infected people is not the same disease process. And that is the reason why I changed my mind. And it took me a long, hard while, a lot of thought to come to that. But I think it's wrong not to include these things. I think that these things represent a big mortality and immune dysfunction.
Thank you. I can't figure this question out. I'll try to answer it before. First, epidemiology is not a pure science. Epidemiology is a fairly clean design. But we never have the luxury of being an absolutely pure science. And there are always compromises both in specificity and sensitivity that we have to make in our case definition. So we don't hold ourselves out as being in any way even near accurate palatine science. But what you say about the nature of tuberculosis, pulmonary tuberculosis, in HIV-infected persons being very different from that in non-HIV-infected persons is a very good point. And to that I would respond that it would then be appropriate to somehow characterize a form of pulmonary tuberculosis that you can describe that is different, and that be included in the surveillance case definition, while continuing not to include ordinary or common garden variety tuberculosis that responds as expected to medication. CSTE is and remains open to new information that would suggest that the inclusion of that or other conditions would be appropriate. And don't mean in any way to suggest that we would never agree to their inclusion, just that the data that are available now do not support including or that the distinction between the forms of tuberculosis has not yet been made well enough for us to include pulmonary tuberculosis.
Let me just take the microphone away from Kathy to say that your argument was very cogent. And frankly, I got so wrapped up in it that I think I could laugh. I could listen to you forever. But the interchange took 15 minutes.
No, it didn't. And,
no, it did.
No, but if you're going to be the eyes of the epidemic, which is what you are, then you can only see what gets counted. If you don't count it, you don't see it, and you don't care.
Dr. Krim has changed her plane to take a later plane. If everybody could please keep it down to a minute or two, we'll still try to be out of here before 7.
I will be brief. Mary Boss, again, from the New Jersey Women in AIDS Network. Speaking for the coalition, I just have to reiterate that our intent in offering this compromise is to get a more scientific 2020 vision AIDS definition. You have enough data, enough scientific data about morbidity and mortality to add pulmonary TB, recurrent bacterial pneumonia, and invasive cervical cancer to this definition, which would count more people, which would be more accurate. I think it's very important for the CDC to acknowledge clinical experience in dealing with people who have been outside of studies. We did that with men early on in the epidemic. We can do that with women and injection drug users. It's true that women's health has been ignored systemically. So take the lead, CDC. Acknowledge invasive cervical cancer in this definition. One other thing. We, as offering this compromise, are not talking about benefits. We made it very clear that we are not talking about benefits today. It is an entirely separate discussion. We can move forward. Remember what Dr. Packloser said. 15-20% of her patients die of HIV-related conditions without ever being counted. Change that.
0.9% the next step. I would like to make a brief statement that interpretation of the new rates. Our country's health system has been using the guidance of CDC as issued since the beginning of the epidemic. Therefore, any significant changes such as this are still affect the way policies and management of each other. Although we recognize that CDC policies are created for this country, it is a fact that those policies also affect our countries. We support the need for expansion of the AIDS case definition. Welcome the inclusion of pulmonary TB and cervical cancer as HIV infections. Our population, as it might be expected, these diseases, which are common in the general population, are being identified in great numbers in the HIV infected people. We partially use the CD4 legal site cams for surveillance purposes in HIV infected individuals. I also have some comments. Mexico and many other countries, CD4 cams are used in only a few centers to guide management following the accepted standards. However, the limited availability of pulse oximeters, the great expense of the test, and the frequent lack of quality assurance makes the use of CD4 lymphocyte counts as a defining criteria for AIDS of very little applicability in our country. While we recognize the importance of CD4 counts as a guide for management for the HIV-positive individual, we feel that using it as a surveillance criteria for AIDS in our country will most likely result in a great underreporting of cases than the one that is currently already taking place, and will certainly consume a large amount of resources that are badly needed for other purposes to occur these patients. Thank you.
Can I don't know exactly who this question would be addressed to. I guess it would be addressed to the people that were here at the beginning of this epidemic. How much